Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for an intelligence briefing on what I think of as the war for the free world. This war is, of course, becoming more in evidence by the day. A lot of us have ignored it for a long time, but not our first guest and regular contributor, Diana West. She has been on this story and thinking hard about its various implications and challenges for quite a while, and doing so with great effect at her syndicated column. You can find it at dianawest.net, as well as in many other outlets. You also will, I hope, be looking for her books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. Diana, good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank.
You've written a couple of pieces that I want to talk with you about that are quite, invigorating, shall we say. Let's, first of all, visit about kind of your thoughts on what's been happening in Iraq of late and the prism that it provides us for thinking about American policies. On the one hand, sort of the neoconservative agenda that you've described with critical concern that gets us sort of with abandon into various places we shouldn't be. On the one hand, and on the other, the sort of neo-isolationist view of Rand Paul, for example. Where do you find yourself falling, and is there a middle ground?
I think, of course, there's a middle ground, because the terminology that we've been sort of saddled with in terms of trying to look at America's role in the world is sadly lacking. I mean, we have the interventionist neoconservative side, perhaps exemplified by Robert Kagan, who is now actually prefers to be called a liberal interventionist by his own quotation in a recent New York Times piece, not a neocon. And then we have what is known as the isolationist side, which Rand Paul is certainly probably the most vocal politician on. But I think the very terminology interventionist and isolationist, once again, is sort of a bludgeoning of a very complicated, well, not so complicated program, namely beginning with national interest. National interest does not mean that we are isolated. Of course, we have interests elsewhere. We have friends elsewhere. However, the program we've been on under the neoconservative wing of Republican politics, and certainly is carried forward in our war policies in the Barack Obama administration too, I think has lost sense of a national interest. I think it is very much a global outlook and does indeed see America as the world's policeman. Does that always mean we are acting in American interest? I think the evidence after a decade is that no, it does not. And I think what's happening on our border is proof that we have absolutely forgotten what our national interest is. We have no border, and we are worried about Iraq's border. That's sort of in a nutshell.
Just staying for a moment with the sort of grand strategy here. So interventionism is something that you can countenance under circumstances in which our national interest dictates it. Do you see in Iraq today the rise of this outfit, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS, on the one hand, and the coming conflict apparently with the Shiite folks from both Iraq and Iran, as such an instance, Diana West?
No, actually I do not. Namely because there is no side that we can consider an ally to join with. I think this is a crucial point, and this is the point that I think in the decade or more of columns that I ended up writing about this very issue, I actually came to a point of understanding for myself anyway that there was nothing for us to win there. We were not going to win the ally that President Bush told us we would win, told us and indeed predicated his entire war policy on, that we would stand up Iraq and have a new ally in the war on terror. That's nonsense. It came out of an absolute blindness to Islam, I have argued. And again, this is also true in Afghanistan. We are intervening where there is not only, I mean, there may be an American interest in peace and love throughout the world. That may be the broader interest. However, there is no practical application of this in such a place because these are Islamic warring nations. These are tribal nations. These are warring nations. And really attaching our interest, our prestige, our men and women and blood and treasure to these warring factions is a lose-lose situation. This is not the front to fight this battle on. That front is not one we can win because, again, it's like quicksand. You can establish a Fallujah, and then it's gone because there is no one there to keep it.
And Diana, again, one of the things that I think you have most trenchantly assessed in those many years of columns is the nature of this, well, enemy agenda that I think is best described as Sharia. Others simply call it Islam. I quibble about that. But whatever one calls it, it is pretty evident that both of the entrants in the struggle over the future of Iraq at the moment embrace it and are hostile to us, which, again, I think reinforces your point that this is not the place you want to be intervening, putting American forces once again in harm's way to try to sort. Talk, if you would, briefly, Diana, about this fellow Ahmed Chalabi, who is a hardy perennial of the Iraqi drama and who apparently is being contemplated as a successor to Maliki by some in the State Department.
Well, it's absolutely fantastical because by many accounts, including worthies such as former General Odierno, Chalabi and his close associate have been in the pocket of Iran. We're actually working for Iran. We're actually transmitting information, enough evidence of serious failings in placing hopes on the man's head exist. And the idea that he is called forward again is absolutely, I mean, you really do worry for the sanity of the people in charge. There's not only no institutional memory, there's just absolute bad instinct. So that's what's going on there. And I would say that one thing I'd like to add to national interest, I think drilling, fracking, et cetera, are in the national interest right here. I think that offsets whatever kinds of worries people then begin to have about oil and things like that, obviously quite important in our national interest. We should never be dependent on this incredibly contentious, warring, difficult, and again, hostile part of the world for our energy needs.
You know, Diana, this is a subject for a much longer conversation than we'll have time for today, but I really am convinced that you're right about that, of course. The answer is not simply a matter of trying to extract more oil and natural gas from, you know, our own resources, though I think that's part of the answer, but to use at least some of that product, notably the natural gas piece and perhaps coal, to produce methanol, which most of our cars these days can, in fact, be adapted to burn. And by so doing, provide both fuel choice for consumers and an enormous lever on what is otherwise basically still a cartel-dominated sector, namely the oil industry. And so it's a fascinating and very important point to make in the context of grand strategy. We'll come back to it again and again. Very quickly, before we let you go, you have indicated, much as you've been concerned over the years about Sharia, that multiculturalism may be an even more messianic ideology than even Sharia. Talk quickly about that, if you would, Diana.
Well, this is something that, again, over these years that I have come to this conclusion that there is indeed a more messianic cult-like program in the world, movement in the world. It is multiculturalism, which is just another word for cultural Marxism, the entire sort of collectivist movement. It has many guises, many degrees. We call it different things, from progressive to the, I call them the terminally tolerant, etc. And the reason that it is more powerful, I guess, in its souls of its believers, I believe, is that it does seem to be driving even their enabling of incursions of Islam into our legal systems, into our cultures, dominating our countries, all in the name of this very utopian, zealous program to sort of unite the world.
This is the irony of the tolerance towards the most intolerant amongst us, and it is really imperiling us all. I think you're absolutely right about that. Diana, that's a subject for a much longer conversation on another day. Thank you very much. Keep up the terrific work you do with your syndicated column, and of course, we're deeply admiring of your books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, Mark Tooley of the Institute for Religion and Democracy on Meriam Ibrahim in Sudan and what's happening to the Presbyterians. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hello, I'm Gary Sinise. It's been 20 years since Forrest Gump, and the story of Lieutenant Dan's triumphant return to normalcy is still a part of my life. I'm honored to share it with the real-life Lieutenant Dan's living among us, the more than 1,700 battle-injured amputees that have returned home since 9/11. As citizens, it's our duty to ensure these heroes get the care they need. Join the Gary Sinise Foundation and help support America's wounded heroes. Visit GarySiniseFoundation.org.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around.
And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
Are you looking to hire an IT specialist, or a logistics expert, a medical technician, or a security professional? Well, there are some very qualified candidates out there. America's wounded warriors. These men and women returning from battle are eager to get back to life at home and a good job. Some have wounds you can see, and some have wounds you can't see, like post-traumatic stress disorder. For these accomplished professionals, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to the civilian workplace. These warriors have world-class job skills and a unique perspective on teamwork. And to ensure proper placement for each individual, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right candidate for the job. When your company is looking to hire talented, highly trained employees, contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home, the brave.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved, and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
back. We're joined by Mark Tooley. He is the president of an organization that I value very highly, the Institute on Religion and Democracy. He has been its president since 2009. He is a former CIA employee for 8 years and the author of two books, Methodism and Politics in the 20th Century, and before that, Taking Back the United Methodist Church. Mark, welcome. It's good to have you with us. Thank you so much for what you do and for joining us to talk a little bit about it.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
Your colleague, Faith McDonald, has been particularly engaged on this issue, but I know you're tracking it as well. Talk with us a little bit about the saga of Maryam Ibrahim in Sudan. What is her current status, as best we can tell?
Well, she is a Sudanese woman who was arrested and sentenced to death for apostasy. She had married a Sudanese U.S. citizen who was Christian, and she is now Christian. And in Sudanese law, that was a violation of Sharia, of course. And she was pregnant when arrested and literally gave birth in prison. And because she is, and so her children are U.S. citizens by virtue of their father. And so it's been a roller coaster in terms of whether or not the Sudanese government would proceed with her continued imprisonment and ultimately her death sentence. I suppose under Sudanese law, because she had a child, she was given additional months reprieve from the death sentence to wean the child. And there have been various reports over recent weeks about her ostensible release. But then it has turned out that those reports were inaccurate. And just today, or yesterday, there were several different accounts of her whereabouts and her situation. She was released. She wasn't released. It now appears, as I understand it, that she is no longer in jail. But, of course, she's still there, as I understand it, in Khartoum. And so not yet safe by any means.
What I understood, and Congressman Mark Meadows was on our program and announced that the Sudanese ambassador had relayed to him that her death sentence had been overturned on appeal and that arrangements were being made to extricate her and her family from the country, bring them here to the United States. We were told that she was detained at the airport, and the charge was that she had some, you know, fabricated documents or something for her travel. Obviously, this is a hugely sensitive issue for many of us who believe that the Sudanese government is no good, and we pray for her safe departure from it. Mark Tooley is our guest. He is the president of the Institute on Religion and Democracy and an authority on matters of faith in the United States, among other places. And Mark, I wanted to ask you about a troubling story that I came across the other day, which is that the Presbyterian Church USA, as it calls itself, voted, I believe last week, to engage in divestment of three companies that had been held in portfolio by the church as a result of those companies doing business with the State of Israel. What's up with that? And do these folks speak for Presbyterians more generally, and for that matter, other people of faith at this point?
Well, the Presbyterian Church USA is the only major religious body in America that has divested against Israel, and it's been at least a 10-year battle for the denomination, which is now at 1.7 million members. They had first divested way back in 2004, and that created such an uproar internally and externally to the church that they revoked it in 2006. 2 years ago, they came within two votes at their General Assembly of divesting. This year, last week, divestment passed again by all of seven votes. And as you mentioned, targeting Hewlett-Packard, Motorola, and Caterpillar for ostensibly profiting from Israel's occupation of the West Bank. So, of course, Jewish groups have been very outspoken in denouncing this action, but also many Presbyterians, and one of the major problems was that many Presbyterian conservatives have quit the denomination for its having liberalized its sexual teachings, and not all liberals, of course, were in favor of divestment. There were some many outspoken liberals who spoke against it, but not enough, and so it did pass, and that's where they stand.
I have been told, Mark, and I'm sure you know better than I, the internal dynamics of the Presbyterian denomination in the United States, that this is a product in part of the fact that many of the faithful have left this particular organization and found, for a variety of reasons, that it's inhospitable to them. This is not the only example, it would appear, of churches being riven by pressures among them. I think perhaps those generated by a very insidious effort being made by Sharia-adherent Muslims to engage in techniques known as bridge building and interfaith dialogue for the purposes of, well, I think, suborning the church or at least fracturing them. Is that going on in this instance, do you think? And is it something that we should be concerned about more broadly among the community of faith in the United States?
Well, it's true that all of the liberal mainline denominations in the U.S. have long been very devoted to interfaith dialogue and have assigned great importance to collaboration with Islamist-related groups in the U.S. That's a troubling story. It's not a new story. What's more troubling is more evangelicals now are engaging in that same process uncritically. And there's a whole new generation of evangelical leadership who psychologically want to be whatever the opposite is of the old religious right. And for them, on that issue, that means more collaboration with the Muslim groups that very often tend to have Islamist ties that they're either very naive about or indifferent towards. And so that's a troubling trend that needs to be watched and hopefully countered.
I couldn't agree with you more. Mark, this is happening, and it makes it all the more troubling, really, at the very moment that we're seeing what Islamists are doing in their own countries of origin to Christians, notably in Iraq, but also, at least until very recently, in Egypt and Syria, of course, and other parts of the Middle East. Is there just a complete willful blindness taking place here within the these denominations as to what's happening to their co-religionists in these countries, or are they being, as I say, kind of subverted by skillful influence operators who somehow manage to obscure that reality?
Well, at the same time, there's greater awareness of the persecution of the church in the Middle East, and there's also ongoing indifference, which is really stunning. So, for example, earlier this year, as you know, Congressman Frank Wolf helped to organize an ecumenical statement on behalf of persecuted Christians, especially citing those in Syria and Iraq. And it was a wonderful statement endorsed by scores of major religious leaders, Catholics, Eastern Orthodox, evangelical, even some liberal mainline Protestants, even the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church. Almost all of the other liberal mainliners declined to sign, and specifically the Methodists did not sign because the Palestinian issue was not mentioned in the statement, although, of course, it didn't relate, and the Presbyterian Church USA officials did not sign. So there is ongoing indifference to the plight of the persecuted church, especially by the liberal Protestants, but it's a growing issue among evangelicals as well.
Well, I pray so, and I know that you are in the thick of it, as you are the fight for religious freedom and tolerance the world over at the Institute on Religion and Democracy. We salute you for that work and appreciate very much your taking some few minutes here to talk about how it matters really to all of us, not just to people in one or the other of these religious denominations. Come back to us again, if you would, Mark, very soon, and particularly keep us apprised of this developing story with Maryam Ibrahim, kind of a classic example of what happens in the hands of these Sharia types. Next up, we will be speaking with Jim Hansen. We'll get the boots-on-the-ground perspective on this war for the free world right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. So, it turns out there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq after all. Indeed, unknown quantities of nerve gas and other toxic agents were left in place after we liberated the country. At least, some of that ordnance apparently is now in the hands of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, the jihadist army that currently controls large swaths of both countries. Worse yet, some of Saddam Hussein's former chemical weaponeers may be back in business under the new ISIS management. It's unsurprising that leftists and other critics of the George W. Bush administration are not recanting their outrageous libel that Bush lied about WMD to justify a needless and murderous war. The unanswerable question is, why are Bush partisans still allowing them to get away with it? This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat, too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, wherever the mission takes us, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Welcome back. From time to time, we turn for a boots-on-the-ground perspective on the matters of national policy and security that we focus on here from our friend Jim Hansen, a former technical weapons sergeant in the United States Army Special Forces, a man who has spent a lot of time in the war for the free world at the pointy end of the spear, as they say, and who really helps illuminate for us in a very practical, common sense way how I think a lot of men and women in uniform are thinking and feeling about the challenges that we're facing and how we're doing in rising to them. Jim, it's always a pleasure to have you. Welcome back.
Great to be with you, Frank.
You have been writing at Black5.net some very interesting things of late, Jim, and I want to go through a couple of them. Maybe we could start with kind of your overall assessment of the state of the global jihad. We're focused at the moment, I think properly, a lot of attention now going to Iraq and the hash-up that's been made there. We have a group called ISIS, which is much in evidence on the march. What do you make of these cats? What do you think we should be doing about, if anything?
Yeah, what you should be doing is the hard part. Who they are, they used to be Al-Qaeda in Iraq, you know, and we beat them. You know, that's the truly infuriating thing about what's going on right now is during the war, when we were fighting, Al-Qaeda in Iraq formed. Al-Qaeda in Iraq drew thousands of jihadis from all over the world, the jihadi all-star team. Everyone that could get there went to Iraq because they were going to fight the Crusaders and win, and they were going to do all this magical stuff.
You know, and they centered in a lot of places, but mostly they were in the tribal areas where the Sunnis, you know, predominated, and places like Fallujah and in the Anbar provinces and places like that. And there were literally thousands of them from all over the world. And we killed them. We stacked them like cordwood all over that place. During the surge, we killed literally thousands of them. And then during that time, we sent enough troops and we put together a way to actually get the tribal leaders in their own areas, or in the Sunni areas where they were mostly operating, who were feeling the wrath of these, you know, caliphate-minded, Sharia-imposing savages who didn't like it. And we turned them against them. We helped the Anbar Awakening. We helped the Sons of Iraq to go ahead and fight these guys, and we defeated Al-Qaeda in Iraq and kicked them out and turned them into nothing. And they're back. And they're back primarily because we didn't stay in Iraq to make sure that things went well, that the Sunni, you know, tribes were treated decently, and so now they have legitimate beefs against the Shia-led government. But also, in our lead-from-behind mentality in Libya and Syria and everywhere else, we've created, I guess, the grounds for all these Islamist dirtbags to go ahead and regenerate and start again. And it's a shame to have watched this fight be won and then the peace be lost and now the war start all over again.
With us not in a very advantaged position to contend with the problem, as you say, that what to do about it is the hard part, made more so, Jim Hansen, by the reported success of this outfit, ISIS, both through old-fashioned bank robbery and apparently other techniques. I was listening to NPR earlier today. The business model that is ascribed to ISIS is one that combines Mad Max with the Mafia with the United Way. That seems like a formidable money-making operation, but by some estimates, they've got $2 billion to throw around, a standing army of sorts, not huge by any means yet, but presumably a building with that kind of wherewithal and territory that they now control. So, Jim, do you have any thoughts on what the United States should be doing? We talked with Diana West earlier in the program, and she says there's really nothing in it for us at this point, especially with the Iranians being the alternative. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't think we can allow the Iranians to be the alternative. You know, they are right now. But I don't know that we have any desire to let the Iranians be the go-to policemen of that region. I mean, if that happens and our influence is pushed aside, that's bad for everybody because they're not good guys, first of all, as we well know. They're not long from becoming nuked up. You know, I've heard reports that both they and the Saudis are in North Korea, and that there may be a bidding war for whatever the North Koreans can sell them. So that's not going to get any better.
Or the Saudis presumably could just get it from the Pakistanis, I would think.
Yeah, you know, who they're buying from, all that stuff. There's kind of a North Korean-Pakistani combination shopping bazaar.
Nukes are us.
Yeah, you know, I mean, none of that's helpful. But, I mean, the situation of allowing the Iranians to be the go-to guys is awful. I mean, about the one thing we can do that I think might be helpful is to point out that the road of death from Desert Storm, I don't know how many people remember it, but it's worth, if you Google it, it'll come up. At the end of the war, when the Iranians were heading back out of Kuwait with their looted stuff and their big, long convoys of military vehicles and stolen BMWs and everything else, we killed them all. You know, we basically turned all our close air support weaponry on that road, on those roads back to Iraq from Kuwait, and we destroyed everything that was on the road. And every time I see a picture of one of those convoys of pickup trucks with, you know, these jagoffs in tracksuits standing in the back waving AKs around and all the rest of it, it leads me to wonder why we don't do a little bit of object lesson in the fact that we can still stop you from doing bad things. And there's no good guys in those. So I think start there, just to kind of set the stage, and then maybe we can get some people to listen to us.
Well, let's talk about one of the things that the Obama administration is doing, Jim, and that's putting guys like you in small numbers into Iraq to apparently do some further training on the Iraqi military and to assess their needs and capabilities and so on. You've observed at black5.net, Jim, where you write now, once again, prolifically, I'm very pleased to say, about the curious turn that the administration has taken on the legal protections for such forces. Talk a little bit about what those guys are up to, do you think, and the safety, their situation, and particularly this bit about the legal protections.
Yeah, well, I mean, in order to send our troops there, we have to have some sort of agreement about what happens if there are legal issues regarding their actions, regarding what they do, or any of the rest of it. And generally, we negotiate a deal that says U.S. law will prevail, because we don't trust pretty much anybody, and rightfully so. You know, we go a lot of places where the legal systems are nowhere near what ours are. Now, this is the same rationale that Obama used to pull everybody out of Iraq, pull all our troops out of Iraq, and leave the vacuum that caused the current crisis. All right, he torpedoed on purpose. And this is what I heard from people who were there at the negotiations. There was no intention of ever reaching agreement with the Iraqis to keep our troops there. And they used this legal issue as the rationale. They said, we can't reach a deal with the Iraqis. All we can get is a deal where Maliki will sign, the prime minister will sign an executive agreement with us saying that U.S. law prevails. But he won't put it to the parliament because there are too many people who don't want to vote with the Americans, right, and be seen as an American stooge. Understandable. That's Iraqi politics. It had very little to do with the actual safety of the troops, because an executive agreement would have been good enough to cover us. And that's exactly what they're saying they're going to use now to cover the troops they're sending. So all of a sudden, when it's politically expedient, this is just fine. And so when Obama needs it, the executive agreement is fine. But when it actually would have helped to stop this crisis and to help Iraq maintain their democracy and maintain, you know, some way to stop these groups from rising, these Islamist, you know, Sunni groups from rising, oh, no, we can't have it then.
You know, Jim, this is so tragic, and it reminds me of Winston Churchill's formulation of World War II as the unnecessary war. This is such an example of it. And as you say, the sort of cynicism of the Obama administration in having enabled it on the one hand, and now, you know, turning around to contend in a very small and, I'm afraid, utterly ineffectual way with its own consequences is scandalous. Jim, we have to let it go at that. There's so much more to talk about. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. And I understand you might be guest hosting next week in my absence. So thank you for that. And keep up the great work at black5.net and, of course, the Warrior Legacy Foundation as well. We'll talk with you soon, my friend. Next up, Andy McCarthy joins us. We'll get his take on Iraq and the presidential lawlessness, the IRS, and more right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I had no choice the news that was given to me on August 2nd.
Gold Star mom, Debbie Lee.
But I did have a choice how I responded.
In August 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
I chose to put on Mark's boots, pick up his weapon, and stay in the fight for our troops and their families.
And America's Mighty Warriors was born.
Mark's name meant Mighty Warrior. And he definitely lived up to his name.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org, you'll find Mark's last letter home.
Read it, and you'll know what AMW's about.
It's about service to active duty members of the military and their families,
including care packages, visits, and more.
It's about supporting the wounded and the people who love them.
It's about the Gold Star family.
Special retreats, concerts, Mother's and Father's Day events to let them know they're loved and not forgotten. Donations are tax deductible and go directly where they're needed.
Read Mark's last letter home.
And just as he inspired his mom, let Mark inspire you to some random acts of kindness of your own.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Any soldier. It could be your father, your sister, your neighbor, or your best friend. Or it could be someone like this soldier who writes, quote, "This is a great thing you are doing here. Keep up the good work." AnySoldier.com has become synonymous with goodwill and great stuff. The troops really appreciate the effort. Take care and thanks again. End quote. Log on to www.anysoldier.com and find out what you can do to help our deployed men and women in the armed forces.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined, as we have the high privilege of being each week, by our friend Andy McCarthy. I call this the high point of my week. I trust it is for you as well. Andy, of course, is a utility infielder these days. He brings marvelous expertise as a former federal prosecutor. He is a pundit par excellence with PJ Media and National Review Online. Also the author of numerous best-selling books, including most recently, Faithless Execution, Making the Political Case for Obama's Impeachment. Andy, you spoke brilliantly, as usual, but exceptionally so, yesterday at an event that we had in New York City at the Metropolitan Club on the matter of the subject of your book, lawlessness and you applied it to an immediate issue for many of us, and that is the misconduct, the malfeasance, and, well, I guess you might even call it political warfare that the Internal Revenue Service, better known as the IRS, has been waging against Americans. Welcome back, first of all, of course, but talk a bit about your insights into that scandal and what you think we ought to do about it.
Well, thanks again, Frank, for not only for having me, but for inviting me yesterday. It was a great treat both to see you and to be able to speak to your fabulous organization and all its friends in New York. So that was a lot of it was a lot of fun, even though it was a sobering experience in terms of what it was that we were speaking about. And again, that was presidential lawlessness. And as I've highlighted in Faithless Execution, there are really two ways to deal with this, and they're dispositive in the sense that they're game enders, but unfortunately the president's opposition for a variety of reasons has been reluctant to use its powers, and those are the power of the purse. You can defund executive agencies and executive activities. For example, if we have a Department of Homeland Security that does not fund or does not enforce the immigration laws, it's weird to think that we need to be paying for something that isn't doing the only job that we give it to do. So obviously those sorts of things should be defunded. The IRS is an agency that obviously does a lot more harm than good. I think it should be struck. I mean, I think the government should be made to find some other way to raise money, and we should just defund this agency out of existence, since it's done more to violate the constitutional rights of Americans than do anything productive. So that's one aspect of it. The other is impeachment. So it's the power of the purse and impeachment. Obviously, as I write in the book, the public is not of a mind at this point that the president should be removed from power, and that's fair enough. And until the public's convinced, impeachment of the president is a non-starter. But impeachment doesn't only apply to the president. It also applies to subordinate executive branch officials. And for example, at the IRS, where you have people who have been involved not only in abusing the rights of Americans over their political beliefs, but stonewalling Congress, destroying evidence, and obstructing justice, those officials should be removed from power. And there's no reason that articles of impeachment can't be filed against them. And I know that Republicans are reluctant because they think impeachment's politically explosive, but my answer to that is let the Democrats, if they want, be the ones to defend the IRS against the American people. If they want to take that position in the run-up to the midterm elections, I think the Republicans ought to let them.
As Brer Rabbit said, throw me in that briar patch.
Right.
Andy, one of the other themes, of course, that you address a lot in Faithless Execution and in your critique of the Obama presidency, of course, is the extent to which the president has serially engaged in dereliction of duty. One of the places where this seems particularly evident at the moment is in connection with this, well, invasion is the only word that comes to mind to describe what's happening on our southern border at the moment. There's evidence, and it's stunning in its implications, really, that the United States government knew back in January that there was going to be a surge of children coming across this border unaccompanied, primarily, and that therefore preparations were needed to begin to make ready accommodations for them. What does that suggest to you about, well, not just dereliction of duty, but treachery on the part of this president?
Well, you know, look, Frank, I think it's just the blatant culmination of something that's been clear all along, which is that the president not only does not faithfully execute the laws, which is his constitutional duty and oath, but that he is actively undermining the immigration laws for the purpose of trying to set up a permanent governing majority for the Democrats. He's basically trying to get as many illegal aliens into the country as he thinks politically he can push the envelope and get away with without the whole country rising up and screaming bloody murder, and maybe at least in parts of the country we're getting close to that point. And then on the inside, once they're here, There are people who are working night and day to legalize their presence here, regularize their presence here, and ultimately confer citizenship on them and remind them of who it was that gave them these rewards, the Democratic Party, which is actively working to sabotage the immigration laws. So it's a two-part outside-inside strategy, and it's working to a fare thee well. And the shocking thing is to hear people from housing and urban development and, you know, the other government officials who are in charge of immigration law to say that their first priority when a child comes into, is found in the United States, is to unite that child with his family. The first obligation of American executive branch agencies is to protect the national security of the United States and to respond forcefully against foreign invasions, whether they're, you know, invasions by an army of it or invasions of another kind. And what's really perverse here, and I've been arguing about this for a long time, including with people on our side of the political aisle, is that where this thing went off the tracks is surrendering to the federal government the responsibility for immigration enforcement, which the Constitution does not give it, and which states could do a much better job of in terms of moving out of their territories people who are trespassers and don't belong there.
Yeah. How was that conferred, Andy? That I must say, eluded me.
Yeah, the Constitution only provides Congress with the power to set the terms of naturalization. It doesn't give the federal government any enforcement role. And in fact, the federal government had no enforcement role in immigration for the first century or century and a half of our republic. It was a state responsibility. The courts basically invented a federal role with the common sense deduction that border security was a federal responsibility, and I think that's fair enough. But what this doctrine metastasized into was a means for the federal government to preempt the authority of the states, even in state territory, and I think that's where this really went off the tracks.
Yeah, it certainly seems to be completely at odds with the whole principle of federalism and states' rights and all the rest, especially in an administration that is not enforcing the law. Andy, very quickly, you've written about vacuousness in our foreign policy, a prime example being Iraq. What can you tell me about that?
I think Iraq is the same thing as Syria, Frank. It's the same conflict. It's the same players. And I think it's a measure of how wayward our policy has become that the Obama administration regards our mortal enemies, the al-Qaeda fighters, as our mortal enemies if they're found on one side of the of that border that's in Iraq. But if they cross the border into Syria, they become the rebels, and we're willing to arm them.
Becoming more complicated with the elimination of that border, it must be said, Andy McCarthy. Trouble on all fronts. Much more to discuss, I know, and I look forward to doing it with you next week, my friend. In the meantime, thank you again for your appearance at the Metropolitan Club yesterday and for your appearance here today. Keep up the terrific work you do at National Review Online and at PJ Media and so many other places, including Fox News. Come back to us again next week. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow, if you can. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital.